funded PhD at the University of Nottingham, I think, under some of the radical Orthodox guys, which is weird. But the idea was, you know, why is it on the, like, you know, on the right, you've got a relative dismissal or maybe pessimism about ecological issues, or it's irrelevant because everything's going to burn up. And then you've got the progressives on the left, where we can hold hands and recycle. Nobody's really getting to any, you know, substantive stuff in the theological realm. So what are the kind of theological background assumptions that we're bringing to the table? It's not like I want you to do a lot of research. I just want you to think about it. What are some ways we can do that? All right, I'm going to close this door and we'll get started.
So are we going to be doing review on the 8th still or on the 1st?
No, review on the 8th, nothing on the 1st. That'd be cool.
So we won't meet on the 1st as well?
We will not meet on the 1st.
Or November 17th.
What's November 17th? Is the exam?
You have presentations for both dates, November 17th and December 1st.
I'll send the schedule. I think you're looking maybe an old schedule. This is a new one.
This is one of the updated ones.
Yeah, all right. So after Thanksgiving, we've got, So on 11/17, we're just going to push everything back down. And we'll have Thanksgiving. Presentations on 12/1.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So
yeah.
Everything's
going to shift down one.
And
I'll
only have
that.
One day of presentations.
Right, which just means we're not going to meet in person for 1 week.
Starting today,
all right. So what's really exciting is you three plus the folks online have a chance that about 40 people didn't have last night when I came to see the convocation last night. If you're not on campus, we're really developing a pretty robust convocation series. Now, this is pretty exciting because sometimes if you're not really paying attention, you just, you know, find folks that might be interesting to one or two people on a committee. But apparently, our current convocation guest for this week is in high demand. No one knows you're here. That's why I thought this gal was here, because somebody was in the class that wasn't supposed to be in the class. I figured, well, maybe maybe the art faculty are sending people over. But what's kind of weird is I had this, if I can set it up this way, I had this interesting email. I want to share the whole thing. Maybe I'll talk about it in the podcast tomorrow. But there was a pastor's wife, and she's an LCMS pastor's wife. And I had gone up to Ventura, where she was, and her husband's a pastor up there. And we did a presentation on art in theology, I did, and it's not going to be as good as this. But we were really kind of interested in the kind of starvation, the aesthetic starvation of the LCMS kids. And I was asked, more of a question. We have probably got better art than some traditions. You know, the Reformed don't even want to see our statue of Jesus out front of the chapel, that sort of thing. But we have an aesthetic starvation that's almost more like metaphorically so. The artist expects a certain creativity and freedom that we're not given in some cases in catechesis or even in theology. Right, even in what we're doing in this master's program or whatever. I'm not saying this master's program doesn't do it, but the expectation is confessional Lutherans have a set of answers. Why are you asking too many questions about how you get there? This isn't geometry, just memorize the stuff at the end. And the person who is interested in theology might sometimes be somebody who's interested in art too. And the person who is interested in art and theology, when they make the move over from one to the other, and they dabble in our world, the theological, ethical, philosophical world, in the Lutheran tradition, sometimes feel very suffocated. Because what we've sometimes done is, to use her husband's phrase, we have used kind of a confessional identity that's unique to a cultural context for German Lutheranism in America that makes the confessions more of an electric perimeter fence as opposed to a lighthouse. If you think about what that means, the lighthouse metaphor would say this is a beacon or this is something that we're drawn towards the center. Whereas the boundary metaphor gives us the sense that we're standing at the edge of the fence, looking out over the other side, saying, how come I can't go over there? And so what we were talking about at this just nice wine and cheese thing at this church was the way in which the kids, precisely because of the way we kind of think about faithfulness to a confession, or the way it's become that the young people are leaving the church because they're standing at the perimeter seeing how far out they can go, as opposed to saying, what's this light that's over here? What informs a kind of way of life or an ethos or whatever that gives us a certain level of freedom, but also is invigorating, right? So there's lots of questions we've got, and I want you to be thinking about these for a bit, but why would we be talking about ethics and art, and especially modern art? Well, you know, a lot of the hackneyed conversations end up being about abortion, gay marriage, what are the other ones? I don't know. They're important, but these are the things we deal with all the time. But I think it's nice to be able to step out of this for a bit and talk about things that maybe predate your awareness of the culture wars. And I want to maybe start our conversation by thinking about some of the controversial stuff related to public conversations about art related to, say, something like Piss Christ or Mapplethorpe or whatever. It kind of creates in some conservative Christians a reaction that makes them think that the entire modern artistic world is just dang suspect. And I understand why, but what I was getting from just a sweet pastor's wife is that it's not only starving, but driving away young people in her congregation after they get out of catechism. So I think this is incredibly important for most of you because you're all involved in some way in some kind of church work. So that's going to be part of it. We'll deal with ethics and art. But let me introduce our guest. Thanks for being here. Dr. Daniel Seidel is an art historian, and he's the author of God in the Gallery, A Christian Embrace of Modern Art. And he's at King's College. Are you still at King's College doing this thing? Tell me about this for a second before I keep going.
I mean, yeah, I do. I have a residential appointment at King's College, so I commute up from Fort Lauderdale.
So you teach at a seminary. Living in Fort Lauderdale.
Living in Fort Lauderdale, teaching seminary classes on vocation, arts, and culture at a Presbyterian seminary.
There you go.
And then I go up to New York and teach modern art history classes.
That's gutsy. Every once in a while, I mean, they have some big names up there every once in a while that it's really cool to see. I think they even had Francis Collins, who was $50,000 for a 50-minute lecture that he'd come out there. I mean, not probably for them, but people that people that are really getting into the fray, and I really respect that. And one of the things I was hoping that we could do even in the next couple of sessions as we talk. Kind of conclude our discussion of ethics over the semester is the ways in which we can reinvigorate the public relevance of Lutheranism, because we're so worried so often about unionism and doctrinal purity that we forget to even be on the map. Not because we want to be on the map so we can grow our churches only, but so that we can actually do something, matter, be relevant. So do consider checking out God in the Gallery, especially if you're interested in the subject. So your presidential scholar, that's what that is at King's College. And then you're down in Fort Lauderdale. You're your doctorate in art from the University of Iowa, and your Master of Arts in Art History, Theory, and Criticism from Stony Brook University. Let's give them a small 3-4-person golf clap. Thanks for being here. All right, so what have you been talking with the students about? If you could just summarize real briefly your basic premises related to.
Yeah.
The ethics of contemporary art. I mean, is this just like a dead end? Is this a disaster? The postmodern world is come crashing down on us, and everything's to be fled.
What I talked about last night, given the fact that it was a core curriculum convocation. Was to put the history and development of modern art within the larger context of the Western artistic tradition and to put it in conversation with the core curriculum. So that art is usually looking at the core curriculum here at Irvine, but also at King's College that has a great books, Western civilization curriculum. Art is kind of like the last bastion of a refined education. So once you do the kind of heavy reading, thinking, then it's time to decorate it, visualize it. So a lot of times historians and philosophers in this tradition don't really think about art until it's time to figure out a cover image.
Mm-hmm.
And so
decoration.
It's decoration, it's an illustration, representation of dogma, theology, ideas. And so what I talked about yesterday in terms of the development of modern art, what has interested me is that if you could say that, say, Raphael in 16th century Rome was painting theology and doctrine, what the artist would identify himself as a modern artist in the 19th century was actually painting theology. But you had to understand theology in a particular way, which I think the Lutheran way is the best possible way, in that theology isn't saying some things about God or saying dogmatic things about God. It's a certain kind of existential relationship between God who justifies and something being, and that there is this relationship. And obviously it gets distorted by Feuerbach. It gets distorted in kind of an anthropomorphical turn where you say, well, but then we invent God. But there's this relationship that you live coram Deo and coram non you. And I see that as in the history of development of modern art, artists are living for the face of something, a demand, a judge, and they are trying to work out what it means to live for the world. And so the work itself is doing something different. So for Raphael, the Renaissance, if there's no patron commissioning you, there's no Raphael, there's no painting. There's no altarpiece, there's no fresco, there's no decoration in the Pope's library. But that changes in the middle of the 19th century. Artists are now making work outside of the context of patrons in positions of power, commissioning. Oh, by the way, I want my wife and I kneeling at the cross. And in the context of Renaissance painting, those are the parameters. In the tradition of modern art, the artist becomes free in many ways to do anything. They have to do something. And the certain kind of choice, how they go about doing that, I think is a deep theological implications, which is what the artist is doing. Belief, unbelief, their faith is operative in artistic practice. It becomes so under the influence of Romanticism, but really, 19th century art becomes religion, means of working out what it means to be human. So a whole anthropology, a whole cosmos, or theology, and this theology is articulated through artistic practice, which means the works of art are looking differently, And one of the things that I have found that has been interesting to think about is to think about the distinction Luther made between theology of glory and theology of the cross, that no doubt up to modernism in art, art was a theology of glory. It is the painting of the heroic, the triumphant, the strong, the powerful, the virtuous that you emulate or that you venerate. Within the context of modern art, I hesitate necessarily to call it the theology of the cross, but the emphasis is death. The emphasis is failure. You have artists now not painting these glorifying paintings of the souls of the departed entering into the bosom of Mary and Jesus. Now there is a hole in the ground, and they're throwing into question the ease with which one can make the transition from this world to the next. And that aspect of vulnerability and failure and anxiety is powerful and profound. But in terms of ethics, or in terms of how a couple ways to think about it. One way is how we learn about
His Christ, or we learn about controversial works, is on our Huffington Post feed. Or mm-hmm. We're minding our own business, not caring about art. Most of us don't care about art. And then all of a sudden, we find out that a painting that Edvard Munch painted, The Scream, one of four versions, went for $129 million in Sotheby's. We say, oh, that's outrageous. It's a work of art worth $129 million. And then the conversation takes place around whether that work of art is worth it.
That's our artistic conversation.
So you have someone saying, well, look at it. It's my kid could paint that. Oh, that's mm-hmm. awful. That's not Michelangelo's Sistine Ceiling. Or you say, oh, that's, you know, there's so much injustice in the world and $129 million. All of that is operative, is generated from a particular microculture that nobody knows about, that nobody cares about. And yet it becomes a spectacle that then kind of runs into the cycle of what the public discourse is about. And it's usually about finding upsides. It's about, you know, it's, you know, however the kind of polemical discourse takes place. And so there is a dynamic, say, with Edvard Munch's painting. Yes, it goes, fetches $129 million at auction. And then Munch painted it. Munch said that art comes from joy, and Munch painted in the late 19th century, early 20th century. He said, art comes from joy and pain, but mostly from pain. He said, I paint my soul's diary. It's an effort for me to try to find truth in the world. And I hope that the person who sees my work, it will help them in their search for truth. Mm. Now, what's happening there, what he's doing and how he's thinking, is not what's happening with the $129 million at auction.
Totally different things.
And yeah, it's not happening with the discourse. So a talk about contemporary art takes place over, isn't it outrageous that a British artist stuffed a shark? And, you know, or, you know, Jeff Koons and a poodle and all of those sorts of things. Those become kind of tips of the iceberg that are ways to talk about how culture's awful or how people who don't like it are fundamentalists. And so the discourse itself, the ethical component is that the words we use about art matter, that art is carried through language. So my own personal conversion to art happened by reading an art critic's review. No images. I read the review, this essay on Andy Warhol. I didn't even see images that the works that the critic wrote about, but he was quoting Thomas A. Kempis, Aquinas, and D.W. Whitehead. And
like, is Andy Warhol quoting these folks?
No.
This
critic.
Oh, the critic, yeah.
And
critic.
So, like, wow, this guy's bringing his A-game, intellectual A-game, to a painting of a Campbell soup can.
Yeah.
And that language just kind of expanded my imagination. Like, what is this practice that requires not just thumbs up, thumbs down, I like it, it's pretty, it's not, it's about the good, true, and the beautiful, but it's about participating and engaging in thought in the deepest manner. And so I went to study with that guy. And that, the ethical component is just a recognition that what we say around works of art, whether it's writing about it, or for me, I worked over a decade as a museum curator, if I'm standing in front of a painting, what I say about it, or if I'm standing in front of a terrible reproduction projected from a screen, what I say about it can suffocate it, or can fan the flame and kind of give it space to do something. So Piss Christ, when Serrano's photograph of that of the crucifix that was put in a plexiglass box of filled with urine, giving me this glowing effect. It was described by in the late 80s, early 90s, it was described by the political pundits as a crucifix submerged in a jar of urine. And the image I got, you know, there was no internet. I was a graduate student. The image I got was that it was some sort of performance piece that the artist had taken his crucifix, like from his mother's house or something, put it in a jar and peed on it. It was that kind of, it was the language created that image. And it, I still have that image. I still have that image that I, that was in my mind when I read a George Will or a Bill Bennett op-ed, or I had heard it described in various ways. But when I actually saw the photograph, I was shocked by the vulgarity of the title and the beauty of the piece.
Mm.
And that was the work.
Right.
The work was that. It was that dynamic. But it was totally lost because the language had suffocated it, and it was just turned into something else. And what it was turned into really had, to my mind, had nothing to do with religious imagery. It had to do with trying to find something that could generate interest on the part of conservatives to shut down the federal funding of the arts. That was the goal. And so that work was used for those purposes. So I really feel that, the beginning, I mean, that there is responsibility to talk about art in a particular way. So as if theology is responsible talk of God, about God, then art has to do with the interpretation of art. Theology of art has to do with speaking responsibly about art. Perhaps always giving it best construction, or at least understanding the context within which it was transacting, and how, and the fragility of a work of art in the modern tradition. That it's vulnerable, that it's always potentially misunderstood, mishandled, ignored, and not cared about.
Can I ask you a clarifying question?
Yeah.
Let's speak as loud as you can.
Clarifying question. The works that you're mentioning are postmodern works. No.
I don't know. I really don't know what that means. Honestly, I really
That's actually an interesting question. Yeah, what's the difference between, let's say, like when we say modern art,
yeah,
postmodern art? Can you see?
It's hard to tell the difference. And I don't. I would describe post-modernity and contemporary art as a loss of a historical trajectory. So there is a greater capacity for aesthetic diversity.
In postmodernity.
Yeah, in postmodernity.
It would be fair to say we could have it maybe easier to identify postmodern architecture. Certainly easier to identify postmodern philosophy, perhaps.
I was reading Heidegger's letter on humanism, his response to Sartre, and Heidegger isolates metaphysics as subjectivism. I mean, it's this, and the whole notion of a worldview and a world picture is deeply subjective. But oftentimes, when I hear within the context of the church, postmodernity is that subjective.
That's all it is, right?
It's relativism. It's relativism. But that has the very beginning of it starts with a Renaissance painting. It starts with perspective that opens up a world for you that makes sense where you're standing. So then that painting opens up for you, and the world makes sense, and it's continuous with the world that you are standing in. But it presupposes a firm foundation upon which you're standing. So there's a deep subjectivism in Renaissance painting that presupposes this foundation upon which the individual stands. Which you could say in postmodernity is that. And within modernity, you could say within modernity, that foundation is not quite so clear. And you could say maybe in postmodernity, that foundation doesn't matter, or that foundation is defined now according to gender or sexuality or nationality or that kind of thing. So, but I still don't know where the class is in terms of how it would separate itself from modernity, except it's possible as I think about it. Listen, modern art under the conditions of modernity operates like a religion, operates within a context of, say, faith.
Modern art does.
Yeah. There is, the artists are approaching artistic practice as they are approaching religion. It becomes a theological work, secular theological work. And it's not uncommon that work has religious imagery. It's utilized in different ways, and it's doing something else. And maybe in postmodernity, artists aren't even believers in art.
Is it possible that it's almost such an abandonment, or there's more of a sense of abandonment where maybe in modern art, is it possible in modern art there's a sense that maybe we could replace some older superstitious structure or altarpieces with some new vision of the good, the true, the beautiful.
Yes.
Even if it's transgressive, but once you get to postmodernity, there's almost an exasperation or
yes.
Something. Yeah, that would be
yeah, a sense sense that it doesn't
even matter
sense,
itself.
But in that sense, Serrano is modern. Serrano is deeply modern in the sense that he is making art in order to figure out the world. But he also calls himself a Christian. He also will identify as a Christian, which people outside the art world who don't like his work don't pay any attention to. But it's a gutsy thing to admit that in the context of the art world, and he does admit that. But the modern art under the conditions of modernity is an attempt in many ways to recapture the magic of art. The enchantment of it, and make it living, make it coming out of the present. So, and what say Orthodox modern artists will look at and say it was totally appropriate for Raphael and Masaccio and the Renaissance painters to paint Jesus on the cross and to paint altarpieces and to paint cherubs and angels. It was that was of the time, and it was vital. There was a vitality to it. But modern art doesn't emerge in response to Renaissance art. It emerges in response to Victorian, kitschy 19th century academic painting, in which you had nymphs and satyrs running around in forests. That's what they were responding to. The artists were technically proficient and excellent technicians in terms of rendering the figure and the landscape and all of that. But these modern artists were lacking life. They were lacking, the painting was attached to something vital. And so many of these artists were going back to the Renaissance, or they'd go to the Middle Ages, or some in the early 20th century, particularly if they were Russian, would go to the icon tradition, and they would see art coming out of the land in some ways, or coming out of folk traditions, coming out of process in which the artist was a monk, or the artist was a priest, or the artist was a magician, the artist was a shaman, something in which art was attached like to fundamental natural processes and supernatural powers in which art was responding to the mystery of the world. The life wasn't figured out. And so there's an interesting connection between, say, a 19th century academic painter like Bouguereau, who paints nymphs and satyrs, and with a kind of technology, pictorial technology that he's a master of, and a kind of scientism that just assumes that science is going to solve everything, and that they're really, the world is just a puzzle that needs to be experimented on, observed, and then figured out and sorted out. And so what artists and poets and other creative individuals were trying to respond to was to try to recapture the mystery of the world. So they respected, anyway, they were atheists. They respected religion. They respected Christianity as a vital, they couldn't stand the church.
Yeah, they
couldn't stand
Victorian culture.
No, they couldn't stand, but it came out of, there was something vital about it. There was something vital. It was a response to the mystery of the world. There's something, you know, it was a myth, but it was a dynamic, powerful myth. It was, there is not, the search for the historical Jesus in many ways is related in some sense to trying to find, like, or to demythologize the New Testament. Oman's project in some ways has much to do with trying to keep, like, what is experientially real. Or Schleiermacher maybe begins it in the 19th century. Like, there's a religious experience. And then how we represent that experience is varying, but there's this feeling of total dependence of the human being. And that's what these artists are trying to operate on. And so it may not be explicitly religious in a sense, but it is in the sense of offering a model of how the human being relates to him or herself, relates to a divine or a judge or something, and relates to the world. Now, the postmodernity may have much to do, and part of what I would be critical of much in the contemporary art world, which is almost now a post-postmodernity. There are theorists that are talking about even the moment of postmodernity is over. That there just is a sense that art doesn't have any of that. There's no aspiration. There's no deeper experience. It's just a manipulation of, it's just a, it's maybe with postmodernity, there's manipulation of signs in this moment. It's kind of more entertainment, spectacle.
Mm. Oh,
it's a kind of a sense of, it's kind of running through a there's less tension between the $129 million at auction.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist who's making art to stay alive.
Okay, I'm going to pick that one up for tomorrow, because that is an interesting, it makes a lot of sense. I think it rings true, but I hadn't thought of it that way. Let me ask you three basic questions, and then we'll open it up, because I think we'll go anywhere you want, but I want to make sure we cover three. The first is the ethics of, or the question of, as we're dealing with the good, the true, the beautiful. The first is very practical.
Yeah.
What was your religious upbringing, first of all?
Evangelical,
okay.
Conservative, neo-evangelical.
All right.
Carl Henry.
But still enough
Francis
thought.
Schaefer.
Francis Schaefer, right? So you're reading, How Then Shall We Live When You Were Younger? And when would you pick, did you ever read that one? When did you pick it up?
While I was writing my doctoral dissertation.
Oh, good. That was better for you, because I picked it up early on. I was in high school and reading this thing. Now, if you don't know this, Francis Schaefer is, I got this love-hate thing with Francis Schaefer. I'm in high school, sitting in a social studies class, and instead of looking at, you know, a Playboy or a comic book, I'm pretending I'm reading the most boring state-funded social science text. And behind it is How Then Shall We Live, trying to understand the Renaissance and understand art in a way that no one had ever given me.
Right.
No one had given me these tools. Now, the guy was kind of self-taught. And I think he had like 1,000 completely erroneous understanding of almost everything that he ran into, even just the very concept of what humanism was. But there was this thing with Frankie Schaefer. Did you ever read, you never ran into this. So Frankie Schaefer writes this, Francis Schaefer. Yeah, he's the junior, Frankie Schaefer. I think he's a little bit over the top in some of his, TMI. He probably shared a little too much in a book called Crazy for God. But there was one thing where everybody said, here's this book, Francis Schaefer, this evangelical icon who is, to his great credit, bringing to a bunch of evangelicals who are aesthetically starved, who grew up in churches where even a crucifix was seen as theologically problematic, right? I mean, I don't know if you know this, but the you know, that little statue, that statue of Jesus out front of the chapel, my friend Dan Van Voris and some friends, they played a prank and they brought it out from underneath the science building. It was hiding out beneath the science building, and they hijacked a cart, and they got a little forklift or whatever. They brought it out and put it in front of the chapel. Somebody had donated this statue of Jesus. Whether or not it was the greatest statue of Jesus, they were kind of ticked off that the kind of Puritan, what they thought of as the Puritan Reformed sensibilities in the region, with the kind of non-denominational aesthetic of essentially we don't have art in our worship spaces at all. Their senior prank was to bring that, just stick it right down there in front of the chapel, and nobody knew how to move it back because it was too damn heavy, right? And that was their kind of act of defiance against this. It was like, must have been like 99, because I had Van Voorhis as a student, so it was like my first, maybe 2000. But this thing was hiding out there, right? But part of it was, so many of these parents are coming in, and just for purely, I'll say, marketing reasons, you've got a 20% or less Lutheran population on this campus. Increasingly now, we've got Roman Catholics that would be very fine with it. But in the early days, we were competing with Azusa Pacific and Biola and others. And when they came on, they said, oh, I don't know what these Lutherans are, but apparently they're just basically like Catholics. They think that the body and blood becomes the body, or the bread and wine, or the bread and grape juice becomes the body and blood. And they apparently have no problem with these, you know, this kind of Catholic thing. And they only see it as, you know, aesthetically. So that was the act of defiance. But in that world, not only is there that same period of time, or at least the first 15 years before that, art comes out exactly as you say it. It's a part of the culture wars. It's everything wrong with America. It's the funding of it. It's the blasphemy of it and all this. And so you find yourself as a curator and as somebody who grew up in this Christian tradition. Do you ever find, or was there ever an experience where people said, I'm going to question your sanctification or the commitment of your Christianity if you're going to even be involved in this stuff?
Always.
So maybe just kind of share a little bit about
that.
Just
I was hired as a curator in my hometown University Art Museum. So I got my PhD, came back to Lincoln, Nebraska, University of Nebraska, was hired as the chief curator. I'm 29 years old. Starting on my career at our evangelical church, on Sunday, the article announcing my appointment was in the arts section, that Sunday paper, and one of the elders turned around and congratulated me, and he said, "Now you can get rid of all the news at the museum." And that was what he thought a Christian should do in a cultural context.
Can you tell me what year this was?
It was 96.
So I'm trying to figure out how close was that to the, remember there was some cabinet level appointment under, maybe it was Bush that put the robe over Lady Justice, the bare breasts of Lady Justice.
Yeah,
what am I thinking
of? That was around that.
Does anyone remember this one, or is it, you know, so there was what was that guy's name? He was Assemblies of God guy, you know, level enough, and he had, you know, he would always be giving these, you know, as a conservative guy, when he would do his press conferences, he was always there in front of Lady Justice bare-breasted. And so then all of a sudden one day, you see Lady Justice and she's clothed, you know? And so it was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what do you say to that then? I mean, you know, this isn't the first time this came up.
Right,
it's Savonarola. I mean, people are
sure,
uncomfortable.
It's a legitimate question, but it revealed to me the kind of American Christian, or even just the American cultural view that, well, or say the American Christian, that I was one of our guys, and so I had penetrated into this realm of culture, and so then what I needed to do then was to use my power to unilaterally eliminate things that people who don't care about it are going to be happy with. What's interesting?
And they're not going anyway.
No,
probably
they're not going to go anyway. And what I've evolved my way of talking about art in Christian colleges or Christian contexts. It's not going to make you a better human being. It doesn't make you more educated. It doesn't. I've been called to live my life in and through a place and culture that virtually no one is going in. Very few people. And what I do know, though, is that you're called to go somewhere where I'm not called. And that aspect of what that tradition, what the cultural practice, what the, you'd say, the ethics of that particular practice has a certain kind of integrity that isn't available or isn't open for conversation or for comment for people who don't participate in it. So a work of art isn't made for a person who doesn't care about art. And there's no reason why the work of art needs to sit and be judged by people that don't care about it. So most of what happens within the context of the church is people are talking about culture and they don't like it. Or they don't like the particular cultural artifacts. And the answer is they're just not made for you. They're not made for, you have people talking about, the people that I think ethically earn a right to talk about it are the people that are involved in it, that are being shaped by it, the theater critic for the New York Times is not writing theater reviews for people who don't like the theater. They're writing theater reviews for people that love the theater, that care about it deeply, that are maybe annoyed at it, that don't like certain aspects of it, but they're in it, they care about it. The theater critic isn't writing for people that don't like it. And I think that is an artist isn't making work for somebody that doesn't care about it. And so the elder only knows that there are nudes in the museum because of whatever is going on. He's listening to talk radio, he's listening to Rush Limbaugh or whatever. And so he knows that there are things, he knows that stuff's going on, but it's not shaping and forming him. And that the weakest brother often is had within these circles has the perception of being the stronger one. That makes sense.
That's right.
Or the sense of being the one who is always offended.
I see.
In the scriptures, is the weaker brother.
Right, right.
But in this kind of context, they're the holier than thou's, or they're the. And so, how I've tried to figure out how the fact is that I love Jesus and I love Jackson Pollock, and trying to kind of figure out what that means is that the gospel is a place from which that empowers me or generates my capacity outward into this world that I was called on. So called to serve. So I grew up as a Christian. I didn't really think that much about worldview. I didn't go to Christian high school. I didn't go to Christian colleges. I have an entirely secular education. I didn't discover Christian thinking about art until I was writing my doctoral dissertation. So I was, modern art and I had already consummated it. We were a thing. And I was going to spend my life with modern art. And then I read somebody like Francis Schaeffer, or I read somebody who's representing modern art. And it didn't represent what I was studying. I didn't know what this modern art was that he was talking about, but it wasn't what I had spent years studying. And secondly, I'm still convinced that God had called me to do it. So how do I figure out what I'm doing as a Christian, but do it for the artist I'm working with, not for the guy, the elder at this evangelical church, or for people who would be judging my Christian walk or judging the the connection that my involvement in this art world would have with other more important political topics.
Yeah, we forgot to follow up on that Francis Schaeffer thing, because one of the things in Frankie Schaeffer's reflection on his dad was, despite all that, so I was kind of, after I started thinking more about, you know, his take on Pollock and other things, then what he said, though, what the son of Francis Schaeffer, who's kind of this evangelical celebrity, ends up saying is, there was one great value, though. It was the only time he really ever had his dad in his life, was when he stopped being an evangelical celebrity and took him to the museum. So that even if he misunderstood it, there was a conversation there that tapped into something that was meaningful spiritually, mystically, theologically, that was not meaningful in all of the ways of articulating faith that theoretically, or at least according to the, you know, kind of mainstream Christian world, Francis Schaeffer was able to do. So even if he didn't get it, he had a real conversation with his son in a way that he never had outside. And it was almost like this shameful, or I almost got the impression that maybe Francis Schaeffer wasn't thoroughly honest in his presentations, because I think there might have been part of him that really understood, or at least wasn't able to articulate what was going on, but knew there was something there, and so he wanted to be in that world, but he knew that he couldn't be in that world and in the world that you experienced. I think he experienced both worlds, and he chose this other one because he thought he could be in both and still be accepted.
The experience as people, and it's that way with, there's an art historian, a Dutch art historian, whom Francis Schaeffer took a lot of, who was influenced.
Is that a nice way to say it? Some way of plagiarizing.
H.R. Ruckmacher. And Ruckmacher wrote a book called Modern Art and the Death of Culture. But that book, that I find to be horrible, was a series of lectures given to British evangelical students. And yet, I know people that, there's a theology professor at Fuller that studied with Ruckmacher. I know people that spent time with Schaeffer. And the dichotomy, the difference between what they experienced with him, going to museums, and just the spirit that he exuded, is totally different than the writing. And I think you're absolutely right. I think in terms of the writing, the length of the writing, there was pressure to be programmatic, to kind of create a kind of Christian army, kind of a Christian avant-garde of artists. And so what it's been for me as a cautionary tale is, and with my experience of reading these words of a critic published 5 years after the exhibition, I want the writing to do that. I don't want somebody to have to go to Switzerland.
You want to be genuine with
cigarettes. And I want the language to live so that in 10 years maybe somebody may find a book or find something and read it, and all of a sudden the language is doing something that it isn't like giving the meaning of the work, but it's giving that kind of that burst or fanning a flame or creating the potential that art could be taken seriously.
So you talk a lot about vocation, and I think what you're getting at is something that really does deal with the realm of ethics, which is what we're finding is you really need to do your work well. You need to be an art critic while art critic. You can't be a this evangelical spokesperson that happens to use art as a tool to wage a culture war. You actually have to do your work right. Otherwise, you get into that almost false, you know, or disingenuous.
It seems to me that's what Luther's about when he says, do your work as if God doesn't exist. It just shocks people. But the sense of God's not looking over your shoulder, that the work that you're doing is for your neighbor, it's for the work that I do is for that person that's reading it, that is along the path of trying to understand art, or working with an artist that trusts me, or that needs to trust me, that I can give him or her the freedom to be able to make the work that they want to make. And as a curator, I can keep the administration at bay and allow them to do it. But then the administration can trust me, but I'm not going to put them in a bad, precarious position. But it's that's my ethical responsibility. And then to do it in a context as a Christian. But it's not coming back to on Sunday and waiting for the approval of people that don't care. Mm-hmm. really don't care. The people I care about are the people that have the skin in the game. And the people that have the skin in the game, if Jesus is there, or they know that Jesus is motivating me to do it, that's where, like, you're in the trenches. You're in the foxhole together. And that becomes, on the fog of war of shared skin in the game, in terms of the vocational component, that's where Jesus can be offered. That.
So I need to hit two quick questions. The work would be long, I don't care. But I need to get them done because I'm the professor. Is it possible to have immoral art? What would immoral art look like? You know, because on the one hand, we want to protect the integrity of the artist. We want to give them their space.
Yeah.
We don't want to be, you know, the problem as Christians. I don't even care if it's Christian or not. Surely there's got to be something that is decadent, immoral, not just bad, but evil, right? Or if evil is too strong a word, immoral.
I think that's the case. I mean, Oscar Wilde, one of the more interesting and helpful ways to think about art criticism is a dialogue that Oscar Wilde wrote called The Critic as Artist. And Gilbert and Ernest are having a conversation. And Gilbert says that all art is immoral. And within that context, you know, the kind of Victorian context in which art is supposed to give a message, you know, it's supposed to boil it down. What do you mean? Like, as a painter, say I have a message I want to give to you, and so I'm going to dress it up in painting, and then I'm going to wrap it up, put it in a box, paint and all that stuff is like the wrapping, and I'm giving it to you, and then what you need to do is you need to unpack it real quick and get the meaning. And like, I'm the success of it is whether you get what I'm trying to get to you. And usually that kind of meaning is a political meaning or a moral meaning or something. And I think that's in the context in which Oscar Wilde is saying all art is immoral. It doesn't work that way. But I do think there's an immoral, evil art. And I think it has something to do with kind of cynicism that human beings are, that human beings are pieces of meat. That there's something. I don't think it has exclusively to do with language or nudity.
Denial of the imago dei.
Yeah, I think so. But oftentimes when we say that, what we mean is a figure that looks a little distorted is the distortion of the imago dei. But there's something deeper that it creates the possibility that human beings are simply means and not ends to have a context. And I think I've encountered work that has sent a shiver down my spine. And it's work that you've never seen. It's work that doesn't shape and mold high school kids and cause them to murder kindergartners. It comes from some place in which cynicism and...
But even there, isn't there a value? Let's say you've got a nihilist. Is that... Why am I losing power? Are they still good?
This is your screen.
Are they still able to see it?
Yeah.
Pretty good? All right. So let's say you've got this... maybe if there is meaning or no meaning, it's nihilist, it's cynical or whatever. Isn't there still a value to something like that for the conversation? Right? I mean,
yes.
Let's say Francis Schaeffer's right that there's a meaninglessness or a nihilism to Pollock's, the stuff that you would think about with Pollock. Isn't that saying something about culture that we need to address? You know, in the sense that, like, maybe there's a fragmentation, so we say, fine, paint it. If that's what's in a certain sense, it may not be beautiful, but maybe it's true. Maybe it's not good or beautiful.
Yeah.
But maybe it's true not in the ultimate sense, but true in the reality of the person's living in the desert. And
I think that's true. I think that's true. And I think the conversation, and then the responsibility of the conversation is to have that conversation in a
have that conversation in a particular way. And, you know, you mentioned Good, True, and the Beautiful. I've been thinking a lot about it, and particularly in art. We have a tendency to kind of over-realize aspect of the good, the true, and the beautiful, in the sense that if the good, the true, and the beautiful is Christ, and if the centurion looks at the dead, bleeding, naked body of man, a criminal hanging on the cross, and says, "Surely this man's the Son of God," then our categories for what the good, the true, and the beautiful are a little different than what we often mean by the good, true, and beautiful.
Which takes you back to the theology of the cross.
Absolutely, without question. Yeah. So good often means pretty and safe. True and good usually means bourgeois mores, pretty, you know, certain kind of legalistic context. And so thinking about what's beautiful, often what's beautiful comes out of, it's that little flash that comes out of ugliness or darkness. My wife and I watched a movie called Buffalo 66. I forget the movie director's name. He stars in it. Anyway, it's a dark movie, and it's vulgar and all of those sorts of things. And yet, it was Christina Ricci's first film. There's a moment, and my wife isn't like an art critic or isn't sophisticated, but we both just gasped. And it was just, he builds this dark, dark, hopeless movie. And then there's a moment where character makes a decision to go back to the hotel room, and he just kind of turns. And it's that turn, like, oh, it just, it's like, that's beautiful. But I can't tell anybody, I can't tell you that, because you have to experience that. And I can't tell the elder at the church that that's beautiful.
You can't recommend it, they'll get angry at you.
And I just felt it. We both were like, right. And it was like, there was nothing there, but everything was there. Everything that was implied is that he trusted her, he believed her, he was going to go back to her. But it was done in the most subtle movement, where instead of going this way, he begins to go this way. And it was just like, oh, wow. Like that, there was something like out of all that darkness, that light, or that the diamond that shines, but it shines on the background of the black. And so, that's what when the good, the true, and the beautiful get moved into that cultural sphere, it's my experience is that it seems to be used to domesticate rather than to put you on your.
Well, that leads me to my last question. Which is, in this thing that we might describe as a postmodern quagmire, some good things come out of it, some interesting things. But it's a quagmire in the sense that for my angle, I'm a philosophy, theology guy. It's a crisis, in some sense, a crisis of knowing. Mm-hmm. And there have been two angles to get back to the truth, after whatever happened, in the shards of whatever we got. And one angle is, I think, exemplified by Nancy Murphy, a philosopher of science at Fuller. And I think that she would go this way, which is that there's a way to recover the truth through aesthetics. That beauty points us there. The radical Orthodox, maybe, with this idea of divine erotics, desire that's beneath all this stuff that you might think it or kind of tied into just sexuality, but isn't. That maybe sexuality is a beacon or a marker of this, but isn't the only thing. And so I've been interested in that. I'm certainly most interested right now in the way in which virtue and ethics can lead us back to truth. And it still has to do with what you were saying. You can't really enter into this until you really respect and understand who's there. You've got to understand the conversation partners, you've got to understand the artists themselves before you just jump in And I think that's very much a part of it. So I think, you know, it's going to be very hard to convince me ever that one of the ways of rescuing truth is through the ethical and trying to understand each other rather than just the polemics. But to what extent, really is my last question, to what extent could art and aesthetics lead us back to the true? If you've thought about that, or to what is true?
Yeah. I think that when a preacher Lutheran tradition is preaching, proclaiming the gospel, they are in the practice of binding and loosening the conscience, preaching law and gospel, that it's operating, it's opening a heart and giving Jesus to them. Those are two words, and it's experience, aesthetically. Feel it. Quantify it. I mean, you can say, you can go through confirmation class, and I remember with our kids, class that you'd say, what is this verse? Is it law or is it gospel? You can do that, but when you're sitting in a congregation on that Sunday and what you need to hear, you need to feel it. There's an experiential component of it that is deeply aesthetic. And do that. It's an aesthetic performance. So I have found that there is much more, take much more seriously what Oscar Wilde said art is all about. And maybe Luther's notion of conscience, or Gerhard Eibling's notion of conscience, which it's this intersection of a person's identity, like some kind of a little moralistic place, but it's what gets released is true, where you don't really know people that the further into it to art that person goes, the less convincing certain language is, where you say, I believe it's true. You don't know how, you can't offer an articulation of it. It just feels that way. And I think there's a moment in which there is a place where that is legitimate, and I think it needs to be more legitimate. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
So the sense that that's not trustworthy, but this is kind of a postmodern, romanticism postmodern. I think that beauty is beauty is something that is felt, and it's felt in a way that there's conviction, there is, as the gospel is experienced. You can articulate it, say it, but that doesn't mean you actually believe it. What does it mean to believe it? And artists talk about belief all the time. That's what's amazing about artistic practice. And that
you mean talk about it in the sense that you're beholding something and you ask maybe, do I believe the artist, or do I believe this art?
I believe that.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means. I don't know what it, but I believe that. So there's an artist at the Museum of Modern Art, had a retrospective last year. His name's Robert Gober. And actually wrote a review in Christianity Today of that piece, of that exhibition. The last review I'll do at Christianity Today. Because it was rewritten.
Oh.
Significantly, in order
so
to get
a heavy editorial hand for
heavy.
Not just
Andy Crouch's heavy editorial hand.
Wow.
And Gober was an artist, another artist, Charles Ray, was asked about Gober's work. He said, what does it mean? He said, I don't know what it means. I'll tell you what it does say, though. It says, come closer. Come back tomorrow. Be with me. And I think that's the realm of, he's trying to get at something that is the realm of art, the realm of beauty that I think theology can take more seriously, and I think the Lutheran traditions. Tremendous potential.
Potential, maybe not the best track record in the last 100 years.
Well, but in terms of, what Luther has to say, or what a guy like J.G. Hammond has to say about asking him, Hammond was a friend of Kant's and wrote the earliest critique of Kant's philosophy. He refused to have it published until after Kant had died because he didn't want to offend him. But Hammond told Kant, what I do is I Lutherize. And Hammond was like every Bible, very much like Luther in the sense that he said, I saw every book as a little Bible. Just deeply material, deeply bound in creation. And I think the insight of Luther that God became man so that man could become man, be a creature, to enjoy being a creature and being dependent upon God. There's a creatureliness that I think that is great potential.
Yeah, some of you look up Hammond and you'll say, oh, he's a radical pietist, and you'll hear Rosenblatt railing against the legalist. So check that assumption. There's a lot of good riches in his work, even if you don't go for all of it. So open up to the rest of y'all. Take it where you want to go. Questions?
Chuck's got one. Seems like Bach had the right view of art. Oh, sorry, Mike just typed. Seems like Bach had the right view of art as a joyful expression of his knowing God and the gospel. Is this accurate? Comments on Bach and his vocation in light of our discussion?
Yeah, I mean, Bach's particular vocation as a church musician. Given that context as a church musician, I absolutely think that's the case. But I don't think it was I wouldn't use it as a controlling model. And I'm not a person that pines for the day that the church would be a patron of the arts. The church controlled the arts. God bless the Reformation. God bless secular art. But I don't think, unfortunately, there are few Christians that make art that seem to get at the human condition in ways that non-Christians do. I don't know why that's the case. It shouldn't be the case, but I think there's a sense that Christians have to be sending Christian messages. You have to make Christian film, has to be Christian music, has to be Christian art, and has to be a way to bear witness to Christianity. And that's doing your work with God looking over your shoulder in a certain way.
Take that back to our conversation earlier about virtue ethics and the freedom of the Christian Luther, and that's kind of what we're trying to get at. It's not that you want to have a permission to be immoral or lack integrity, but rather this very question of that I love that language of God looking over your shoulder. And it's not just in the realm of the creation of creative work, but maybe in the creation of creative service to neighbor, right? Like we're always trying to say, now what's gonna represent the Christian church well, or the college well, or my particular congregation well, as if it's all like a marketing thing, or it's controlled in that way, rather than just saying, I care about this person who's suffering in that vocation to be a servant, you know, doing that. Others, you've got to...
Yeah. Mike Schultz has a question. Secular humanist thought gets criticized, perhaps rightly, for living off the philosophical, ethical capital of Christianity oftentimes. For example, they talk about things that are wrong when they have no sturdy epistemological foundation of their own for it, and they deny absolutes. But it sounds good to emote over just how unjust or immoral the God of the Old Testament is, for example. Do you see a parallel here in the art world? Do modern, postmodern artists borrow imagery and or allusions to Christianity and Christian themes in order to make a statement about the ultimate or weighty matters through their work, even though they do not subscribe to the Christian faith?
Yeah, and I find it of, I think it's, it demonstrates the creative and evocative power of Judeo-Christian tradition. I don't see it less in terms of a kind of a gotcha thing. Because
like,
it just doesn't.
So maybe I'm trying to follow just to get up a
yeah.
sense of it. There's something, you might even say it's overplayed, but let's say like something like the Wachowski brothers and the Matrix. There are themes there that resonate with, of course, Buddhism and other things, but there's some Christian imagery there. Is it possible that it's not like, hi, you're not allowed to do that? What you're saying is it's not like we're going to say, I gotcha. You're not allowed to do that because you don't have that hope that we have, but rather the thing's just bubbling up because it can't in a certain
yeah,
sense
they're,
stop.
They're compelling stories. They're compelling. They're redemption stories, stories of sacrifice, stories of wouldn't it be great if Aslan was actually on the move? Wouldn't it be great if that were actually true? So you have sort of C.S. Lewis's true myth. And so I feel that, I just feel in the arts that is like part of what I do, part of how I love my neighbor is to emphasize to the artists that use those themes where they come from. And an artist that I work most closely with is an atheist, has a studio in L.A. He reads Augustine's Confessions every year. He and I worked on a project. I curated an exhibition of his work at the Museum of Biblical Art in New York. A single work was of religious content, but there was a structure to it. The structure was a figure in a landscape. The structure was, I argued, came from his deep reading in the Western tradition. Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Hermann Hesse, Boris Pasternak, all of these writers drenched in Judeo-Christian literature. So even though he doesn't read the Gospels, there's a narrative structure. So I don't think that it's illegitimate because he doesn't live by it. And I don't even know like that the absolutes. I don't even know what that means. I don't even know what absolute means anymore. In that context, I don't know I think it's in the context of art. I just wouldn't know what that means. I mean, I know that you know in terms of absolutes, in terms of God's law, but God hates divorce, yet he allows it. Okay, so God's a relativist. So God sees pressure. The pressure is that Jewish dudes are going to kill their wives. And so in order to keep these wives from being killed, he's going to allow divorce. So why does God backtrack on his absolute law? I'm just not all that interested in it. I don't think it, we certainly don't own, Christians don't own the narrative. And I think it's more of a testimony that it's out there, that it's compelling. And if it's compelling, then there's hope. Obviously, they're considering the Christian story. They consider Christianity to be something else other than that compelling story.
Well, at the risk of being sounding opportunistic, I'd maybe paraphrase or do a little poetic license with Acts 17:23. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your art, I found also an art piece with this inscription to an unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, I proclaim to you. Strikes me as something of appalling spirit in the way you describe that reflection on those who seem to be dabbling in something that you would resonate with as true, you know, divinely true, and instead of saying you don't get to play with that toy, perhaps the without taking this too far, you wouldn't want to just walk, hey, let me tell you something, right? You know, this is the Jesus there in your piece, you know, that's, you know, but to resonate with it and say, yeah, this is what I'm seeing in your work. Or I mean, do you ever do that in your Christianity Today, that's one thing. I mean, like, so I mean that's part of the way that you feel at liberty to do that without being disingenuous, or you're not trying to manipulate the thing into some kind of an evangelistic purpose.
No, and that's part of one of the challenges that I'm very sensitive to, though, is Paul has a choice to make. Paul can take that unknown God and say, as a sermon illustration for nihilism or paganism, look how lost they are, they don't even know that God is. And Paul takes the other aspect, is that they bumped into something. They know. They've tapped into something. That work is doing something. And says, I'll tell you about that God. But how he tells us about that God, I think, how we name it, is part of the ethical component of not heavy-handedness. And to do it in such a way that my, you know, for me as a curator or as a writer, writes about art, I want to be very careful that what I'm doing is honoring the artwork. In context, it's about, I'm bringing theology into the service of deepening the experience.
When you say theology, you're in essence referring to the longing that you see in that certain piece, right?
Or I would say just taking, or you could just say, say the longing, but just like the gospel. I mean, it doesn't, or to say, you know, how Paul writes in Colossians that it is all things are made. All things. So it doesn't do me any good as a critic to say, well, that painting's identity made in through true identity is in Christ. Christ explains that work. But how is it that I can take that as an insight? Christ explains all things. It's in and through whom all things have their being. How can I work from that and to say, write three sentences about this work that does something that might feel that way. Does that make sense? And nobody would even know, may not even know, but it's coming out of my acknowledgement that somehow and in some way that painting is part of the all things Paul is writing about. Somehow and in some way, Christ is there. And then given that insight, given that promise, or given that as a faith, how then do I write about that word? Maybe not to name it as Christ, but maybe do something with it. I don't know. I can't tell you what it would. I can't tell you how it would look on every occasion. But it's doing something that makes that work expansive. That it's addressing something deeper.
How many more do we have?
One more typed.
All right. We'll answer this one, and then we'll take up to two more. But if you're trying to type in something and you already see two on there, we'll cut it off after that. So,
I don't mind posing a live question.
So do a live question, then that one, and then there'll be one more after that if anybody wants to jump in. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Going back to your point, that experience you had at the church or was it a university, where someone said, "Now go cover the nudes."
At church.
At church.
Right.
Okay. First of all, thank you for your perspective. It's very rare that we're able to meet someone that's both in both of those worlds. It's really unique. I do appreciate that. I come from a background that, like, I'm a musician, and in my 20s we played music, and the only places that would give us a venue to play most of the time, because it was like alternative rock, was art galleries. And Old Town Pomona, Fullerton, played so many of the shows there. And one time, we opened for a postmodern performance art thing, and the guy defecated on the stage after us.
This wasn't Iggy Pop.
No.
Okay.
It wasn't as cool as Iggy Pop.
No. That turned out to not be true, but I'm sorry.
But this really happened.
Or Frank Zappa.
And Frank Zappa?
There was a legend on Talk About It. Turned out not to be true.
So, but this really did happen. And the crowd that was there just dispersed. And could we apply any of these standards that you're saying to that type of environment? Because that's my experience with this.
Yeah. No, I no. I mean, I think, you know,
right.
There are boundaries.
It
just doesn't
mean crapping on the stage.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
it's like Freud. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Sometimes a guy taking a shit. It's just a guy taking a shit.
Yeah.
And he's trying to be clever, cute,
right.
And that's almost
well,
it seems that almost
right.
seems as bad as like the Precious Moments. You know, cartoon
yeah,
slapping
right.
and saying that it's
easy.
If,
everybody who's going to be offended, the people that are going to be offended are going to be offended.
Right.
The people that think that is somehow a radical gesture are going to think that it's a radical gesture, and that's it. And then it disappears. So
I wonder though how much of that filters down to the people that, you know, that you can make a case maybe don't really care for art. So just it reverberates down to that level of the low information art people. It's just a backlash.
You suggest that maybe that they're doing a disservice. Like, so it not only is it maybe silly art, but it's not good for the art
right.
world because of
It sounds silly for me to say it, but if the guy took a shit every day for the next 20 years on stage, now we're talking about something else.
All right.
Different. So like, so if you have...
I like it.
So if you...
You should be like a coach, too, not just a critic.
Right, every time.
I'm going to take this. I know where we're going with this, all right?
A lot of beats.
I need a lot of beats.
So that you have... So if...
and then blueberries.
It's the daily. I mean, somebody can do... Steve Martin, in his memoir on stand-up comedy, which is a great little book on art, really, it's called Born Standing Up, said it was easy being great every once in a while, but the real professional has to be good every single night, and that aspect of every single night. And what interests me is not just that there exists something in the world that was a one-off that happened, but that it strung together over a life, that a person, and it still fascinates me, that a person can go into the studio and make work, and they go into the studio again and make work day after day after day. So Robert Gober has this retrospective, 40-year retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art, 40 years of his life. I think like all the things that he's done and lived, the challenges that he'd had in his life, his personal life, etc., as 40 years of a human life, what does that mean? It means this. You made this work. It didn't exist before, and it doesn't have to exist. Like, this isn't feeding anybody. This isn't solving any major world crisis. And yet, he generated the passion and desire to go into the studio every single day to make this strange, ambitious, difficult work, and to do it for 40 years.
we could take out one work and say, what in the world is that? What's that doing? What's this cat litter thing? This sculpture that is made to look like a bag of cat litter. But it's in the context of 40 years of making work. It's part of a story. And that's where that aspect of like the isolation. Serrano's Piss Christ photograph is part of a series of photographs that he makes in which he takes other popular religious imagery, so Mary and Madonnas, but also Greek and Roman statuary, and has them lit with piss. So it's piss baiting Diana, piss Apollo, piss, you know. So the desecration that it, the claim that it, he's desecrating Christianity, doesn't recognize that the project was using other popular images that had meaning, other kinds of meaning. And that work situates itself within other projects. So, and those are part of my job, part of my ethical responsibility. It's not to bemoan that like the elder of my church minding his own business, and he's listening to Rush Limbaugh and talks about Andre Serrano, and that's not his fault. But my responsibility is to say, well, here's, if you want to listen, here's a bigger context for it. This is that work in all of this other work. And here are his commitments. And this is why he was doing the work that he was doing, to kind of add context, not to dismiss the response as a kind of a fundamentalist reactionary, but to kind of offer a more context. And so I wonder, you know, the person that takes a dump on the stage, there's no context.
None that I know.
None that you know. And that may, I think that has something to do with that. We just don't. Art is a cultural practice, like every cultural practice that takes practice, that not just to make, but also to look or to, you know, high cuisine. I showed my students a documentary on a Swedish chef who has a 12-seat restaurant. Sweden, the only way, and it's the 19th ranked restaurant in the world. The only way to get there is you gotta like take several flights and have to drive for hours to get there. It's a 30-course meal. You're not going there, you're not dropping by, and you're not going there with taste buds tuned towards Applebee's. You're there because that kind of eating, that kind of cooking, kind of preparing food is something that you are committed to. And so you couldn't go there with an Applebee's mindset. But there's nothing wrong with Applebee's. It just is its context there. And so there are different values with those practices. So evaluating this Swedish chef's meal with Applebee's mindset, it's not fair to the Swedish chef, but it's also not fair to Applebee's. That's not what they're there for. I need to be comfortable, and I need some comfort food, a plate of nachos. That has its particular kind of integrity.
Now you're getting there's a little Marxist thing going off. I don't know why, but it's not Marxist. It's the Prophet Amos. It's a follow-up question, not a new question, not stealing anybody's question. I reject you, says God, your decorative bowls, your ivory couches or whatever. If I would have asked, let's say at Vanderbilt University, you come into this class and I ask you, is there immoral art? You might say, is there a way in which this is elitist? I mean, I just read this Anthony Bourdain thing on this, like, you know, high quality food is important, he thinks. And the way that we've reacted against the decadence of the Wall Street thing is to say, we're not dealing with the nonsense anymore. The $900 bottle of champagne coming out with the busty women and so forth. Because it goes the other way, right? You normally would think that the immoral art has to do with obscenity or pee
and
poo.
Right.
And then on the other hand, there's something that's really, really pretty. And it's not that it was a monk or something. Somebody buying it later on. That's just, it's commodified. But now I'm talking about the fact that we've got some stuff that is created intentionally, kind of like a Cohiba cigar. I'm going to put the sticker price really high and I'm going to dupe you, or I'm going to some of that's got to be. Where do you, like, are there any artists or places that we'd say, you know, this is gone too far. This is too self-important, and it, therefore it's so far out of the clouds that it's lost its grasp on goodness within.
With this Swedish chef, it's interesting because he's writing a book for Faden, and it's about Swedish cuisine. So he travels around the country and studying, investigating, preserving traditional culinary traditions. And most of the dishes that he serves come out of traditional Swedish culinary traditions.
I don't know, I'm getting feisty. So he's like Elvis and Eminem. He's stealing from the peasants.
No, say, he would say what he's saying is he's preserving it because of it. Because so in his view, I mean his words too. He said if a tradition is only about protecting its borders, it's going to die. And the tradition has to be able to innovate. Tradition has to be alive, and that's what he's trying to do. But I do grant. Who can afford go to New York and go eat at Mario Batali's restaurant?
I have a hard time affording local artists for my own home.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, I mean, I think that's...
And I think they deserve it. But
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. The thing with art is interesting is that you can have, like this artist that I work with has this studio in L.A. He had a show in New York. Show sold out before. So that's the dealer's goal. The dealer's goal is to sell the work before it even opens to the public. But then it's open to the public. For 6 weeks. Free. Go to New York, go to the galleries in Chelsea, LA, go down to LA. Look at it. The work may have been sold for $100,000, $500,000, but for the 6 weeks that it's on view, it's free. See it. I have to own it.
So in that sense, the patron.
It's a different.
It's kind of like I mean, whatever you think about Bill Gates, you know, there's a way in which here's a guy who's making tons of money, and he's not even in a kind of a Catholic sense trying to pay his time out of purgatory. It's just like what he wants to do. So there's a way in which the relationship between, say, a patron or a whatever, there's a value. So let's say in the context of the Swedish chef, there's this other performance that he's doing. You're gonna have a 30-course meal, but he's also able to write a book about it. You know about it. You didn't go.
And the thing that I know about it is it gives me an immense amount of pleasure. It's really interesting.
It gives me pleasure to think about,
like,
right?
The whole life. Like,
right.
This guy is, like, that exists in the world, even though I'll never, ever go there, that exists in the world is a wonderful thing. I couldn't be more excited about it. I try to tell everybody. There's, on Netflix, it's a 6-episode series called Chef's Table, and they feature 6 different chefs. It's fascinating. They're all these high-end chefs, but they're all farmers. They're all involved in trying to grow more sustainable crops. The Swedish chef is talking about using cows, dairy cows, for beef, and it's very, very innovative. But the very fact that exists, even though I don't know, I'll never have access to it, is wonderful.
That's a good answer. I like that. What's the last one here? Last word.
From Wes Bearford. Not sure if there is a connection here, but I'll try. I've heard the gospel is not understood, it's proclaimed. I think I get this in a sense, and this is is this analogous to what you're saying about art? Perhaps art is not explanation that you might understand, it's a proclamation that you might experience.
I think that's pretty good. I mean, my understanding is to try to make sense of, I mean, it's faith seeking understanding. And it's not faith trying to get the foundation of understanding. It's faith out of faith understanding. And that's been, you know, all the work, all the theory that I read, all the work that I'm trying to do as a scholar is really in service to the faith that I have in art. And so I think there's something there. I don't want to minimize understanding. I don't want to minimize. I mean, there's a certain point. There's a certain point where there's a all 25 years I've been doing this, reading everything I can get my hands on, thinking about this. And then there's a, I kind of feel like I get to a point where I can't say anything. But I say that to 19-year-old undergraduates, but I also say, you're not in that position yet. Give yourself 30 years. Then you can say, then you can be confident, or then you can rest on your intuition or your feeling, emotions, if that makes sense. So I never want to divorce the mind from the heart, but I want to see the mind as trying to run after what's happening.
But maybe also in Wes's question, this is a nice way to maybe wrap it up. Even though I said you give the final words, so I'll make sure you have the actual final word. Because I know you know some of the guys that would be interested in this and gals. Did we talk in this class about like the first order, second order discourse and theology, and have we not really dealt with that? So, you know, those preachers that might be lacking in the artistry of homiletics would be those who turn a sermon into something didactic, right? That would be somehow failing their vocation. That might lead you to think, well, therefore, I don't need any homiletic professor or a guy who gets a PhD in homiletics or theology. Is there a role for theology in a second order discourse about what goes on in that immediate experience? Of course there is, and it's to better understand, prepare, and so forth. So what you're doing is somewhat analogous, right? You've got the first order experience of the art, which is almost ineffable. It's like the Tao. If you could say it, you really didn't have it. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a whole body of literature talking about the Tao or talking about the experience of God that's ineffable in the mystical tradition or talking about theology, which isn't the thing itself, but gives honor and points to the thing itself. And so in a certain sense, you're kind of a witness to, or like the Grunewald thing. Okay, there, look at that. Right? I don't know what the hell's
finger.
I still don't even know why Dan's got Grunewald on his arm. Because I know it, but he can't even express it, because we'll maybe talk about this tomorrow. My friend Dr. Van Voorhis, it has to do with his struggle with addiction. Right? And there's this whole context to it, whatever. And if you really ask him, I don't even know he would be able to say exactly what it is, but the fact that there's that indication at that point, and that's what you do. So, and with that in mind, thank you very much. This is incredibly valuable for us, and this little group get to benefit from it. So we'll give you another golf clap.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And wait, one more thing. How can they follow you? You've got a blog. Is that the best
way
to
follow? No, I don't have a blog anymore.
So you stopped doing it?
Right. I'm kind of out of the lecture on that stuff. I have a more recent collection of essays called Who's Afraid of Modern Art? You can look at that.
That's a book, or more recent than God in the Gallery.
Yeah, God in the Gallery was 2008.
Okay.
Who's Afraid of Modern Art was last year.
Okay, cool.
On Amazon. Yeah, you get it on Amazon. Cool. I'm on Instagram if you wanna see some pictures of me in museums and whatnot.
That's
so
cool.
So anyway, thank you
very much.
Topic.
All right, everybody. How are you getting back? What are you up to?
I've got a car.
Oh, you do? Okay, good. Yeah. Sorry that we waited a little longer than I expected. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Really,
thank you very much.
It.
Cool, we'll catch you tomorrow. And please, I don't know if I got to get you some coffee, some booze, whatever you need. So you get some of those things back because I can't fill it. Capture this on the. All right, we'll get
great.
All right,
excellent. Have a good night, guys.
See you tomorrow.
Good
take
night.
Care.
Thank you.
So for the rest of you, we are basically done. Does anybody have any logistical questions? We're back next time. We're going to get right back into the GIL stuff on in the environment.
Are you going to repost the new schedule?
I'll put the new schedule up, but for the meantime, if you've already read, then you got a free week here. All right. Cool, thank you. And as we're closing this up, what were you playing? What were you up to with your sound?
Oh, I don't know.
Drop that on us.
No, I couldn't hold that back because that's always been something that's important to me.
Of course you should have brought this up. Yeah. Okay, well, first I got to tell you the story about what it was. So the legend was Iggy Pop and Frank Zappa were in a battle to gross each other out. And Iggy Pop took a poop on stage. And then Frank Zappa ate it. It turns out that Dweezil Zappa said that never happened. It never actually happened. It was just like one of those things like Ozzy, before the internet, all these things happened. Ozzy Osbourne did that off a bat or whatever. I don't know if that's true or not. So it's been done. But so what's your plan? What was your thing?
Guitar.
What was the sound?
Oh, you know.
Oh, here we go. I'll get that.
He hasn't typed it yet.
This is more important than that. So we got here. Peter, question, yes?
Yeah.
You can even speak it if you want. We can jump
hey,
in.
Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to make sure I started working on my paper this past weekend. Did you want to see anything as far as like topics or should I just feel free to work on it as I
Well first of all, what is your topic? What is your topic?
So I'm talking about homosexuality. And
yes.
The main theme is homosexuality morally acceptable today? And so I'm looking to look at scripture to see what scripture says on it. I want to argue actually pros and cons of, you know, can I argue, homosexuality as a, from a, that it's a sin, but can I also argue a perspective that maybe it's not, and then draw my own, and then have a conclusion before getting into part two.
Yeah, I mean the best paper will always have what we call a counter argument, right? So that's all right. So in fact, the better you do at articulating the position that you don't end up agreeing with, the better the paper would be, and that's a great topic. I would kind of stay away from gay marriage because in some ways. Or same-sex marriage. The problem there is it gets so much into constitutional law, which is a little bit different from the ethics of it, right? So the way you've articulated it, it's perfect. It's a great topic.
Okay.
And you can go anywhere you want. There's no, not even an orthodoxy test on any of this.
Okay.
It's not seminary. You can do what you want.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so just to kind of run it by you, so far I'm kind of going with, like, what does the Old Testament seem to say, macro level? What does the New Testament say? Kind of drawing a few different verses, and then doing like a quick context, like kind of taking some things I've learned in some of the other classes at Concordia, you know, more or less, you know, apply it to today. And then in part two, that's where I'm going to kind of cover. Is it okay with you if I cover each ethical issue, like deontologically? This is what we're looking at. Consequential, from a consequentialism perspective, this is what we're looking at, and from a virtue ethics perspective, this is what we're looking at.
Yeah, for anybody who's listening in, the real main thing is you have to do that.
Do you get that?
You can go short or long. Yeah, you really want to make sure you just say, here's how they would do this, and then you kind of just then give a little nod to the thing you think is the most important. Does that make sense? And nobody has to submit anything to me.
Yeah.
It's usually a good idea if you're worried about it.
But
standard stuff is great. And you're also free to send me outlines or just drafts. And if I have time, I'll take a look at it. Somebody, Wes asks, the paper due date was the same as presentation day. Here's the new due date for anybody who's still listening. I'll try to remind everybody. The due date is the day when we upload the presentations. And so I'll submit more. But yeah, there's the only reason you would want it earlier than that is so that you have something that I could be looking at if we were having a live presentation. Since we're not doing that, you can just turn it in at the same time. Did that answer your question, though, Peter?
Okay. So you're saying it is okay, like, because it sounded like maybe before I needed to, like, hone in on one specific one, which I think I ultimately will at the end, but I'm going to cover all three and then have, like, my, this is what I feel strongest or most strongly for, something like that,
yeah.
Right?
No, one
as
of the...
As far as the ethical views at the end.
Yeah, because people are still here. It's very important to know that you should, if I didn't, I think it should be already in there, but you really do need to have at least some exploration of how each of those would cover it. And you don't even have to pick one. You could say, I think all three normative ethical approaches would lead us to X, right? So I would say it's bad to torture babies for a deontological, consequentialist, and virtue ethic approach. And you don't even have to say which one's the most important.
Okay.
All right, cool. All right, thanks, everybody. Have a good night. All right, we'll see you next time.